met, friends. I'm Steph Midlock.
And I'm Jude Vase.
Welcome to Atherbeth, a podcast exploring the gallant green gentleman of Tolkien's Legendarium.
Are we going to be talking about green beans?
Green giant. Kind of.
So at the top of the episode, we want to acknowledge that, yes, we are all still living in the weird world of coronavirus. And simply say that we hope that you and yours are safe and taking the necessary precautions, and that your lives, as weird as they are right now, are as good as they can possibly be under those circumstances.
Yeah, just take care of yourselves, take care of each other, stay home and all that stuff. And we love you. Yeah. And we hope that we get out of this soon.
Yeah.
So we do have a corrections cul-de-sac this month. So I'll just jump in. In early April, we have a really lovely listener and a friend of the show named Patrick M. Housen. And he pointed out on Twitter that we forgot two honorable horse mentions way back in those amazing horse episodes that we did. They were episode 10 and 11 back in like early 2019. So, Patrick, thank you for listening, first of all, and also thanks for mentioning it. So Patrick pointed out that there's these two hobbit bros who set out from Bree, and they're the guys that founded the Shire. Their names are Marco and Blanco. And Patrick tells us that Marco and Blanco both mean horse, and that it's kind of a little inside joke from the professor here, in that the mythical founders of Britain are called Hengst, which in German means stallion, and Horsa, which is like a horse, duh. So yeah, this is kind of a nice little horse moment there that Patrick pointed out. So yeah. Thanks, man.
Cool.
Thanks, Patrick. Patrick can be found on Twitter at Swordbora. And yeah, cool. So thank you so much. I want to call your attention to the artwork that we posted on social media to hype this episode. This gorgeous piece featuring Sir Gawain and the Green Knight was done by a freelance artist named Amanda McFarlane. Amanda has a huge following on social media, and in April of 2020, she completed an art prompt for The Lord of the Rings, so she's done a lot of characters that we all know and love. So please check her out on social media to see these amazing pieces and all of her art. As we post this, she is in Mermay, because it's May, the month of May now. So she's got lots of beautiful mermaid pieces to enjoy. Her Instagram is @theanimatedlife. And her Twitter is also the same, @theanimatedlife. I have to also call out her Etsy store, because she has so many beautiful Tolkien pieces there. Her store name is The Animated Life, all one word. This Sir Gawain piece that you see for this episode was actually done specially for me. Amanda has a really wonderful Patreon, and I am one of her patrons, and this was a reward for me. And Jude and I just want to thank Amanda so much for allowing us to use this gorgeous piece for this episode. It's so special, and I love it. And you guys know how much I love horses, and this piece is very horse-friendly, and I love it. So thank you so much, Amanda. Definitely check her out. We'll put a link to her social media in the show notes. Are there any other things you want to mention, Jude?
No, I think that takes care of our notices at the top.
Sweet. Well, we've got many headless paths to tread, so let's begin.
Let's get into it.
Okay. So what is the purpose of this episode? That is a great question. Why are we all here today? Basically, I would like to discuss the story of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. This tale is soon to be a major motion picture starring the very sexy Dev Patel. And it's supposed to come out at the end of May, but that was before. Did you like that? Hey, little soundbite. What's up, Dev? Give me a call. No, he's not going to. That's fine. Anyway, the movie was supposed to come out at the end of May, but I'm not sure what's happening with it now. With the coronavirus, but whatevs. But our good pal, J.R.R. Tolkien, is, of course, connected to Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And it can be argued that Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is also connected to Tolkien's legendarium. So even this story is kind of, you know, a bit beyond our normal parameters of this podcast. But Jude and I thought it might be kind of fun and timely to check it out. And yeah, right. Do you know, had you heard this story before? Because I had not.
I had because... Okay. To once again name drop Signum, I took a class in Arthurian tales through Signum University with Dr. Flieger, which nice. Was a super cool course. And the Gawain and the Green Knight stuff came up through there because it had a connection to Tolkien. And so we talked about it there.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really, really cool. Mm-hmm. I'll have to see if that's one of those pre-recorded ones that you can go back to and listen, because I'd love to. I just don't know that much about Arthurian legends, so it'd be kind of cool to go back.
A great class. No, I'm serious. It's so good. Dr. Flieger is a fantastic teacher, and it was super, super interesting. Yeah, I love that class.
That's awesome. All right, cool. We'll definitely chime in when you... I sort of handled the bulk of this because this is something I was interested in, but I definitely need you and your notes from Verilyn Flieger to jump in here.
I will.
Basically, I just want to give all of our listeners the opportunity to know more than your friends do about this story if you're going to go see the movie or if you're going to stream it from home or whatever. So we're going to give you a little bit of background about this poem and the manuscript in which it's found. Then I'm going to tell you the story of Sir Gawain in like uber cliff notes. And then we're going to talk a little bit about a nice, interesting connection to Tolkien's legendarium that I hope you like. And let's see, upon completion of this episode, if you listen to the whole thing, if you make it through, I give you permission to act like an insufferable, pompous asshole with your vast knowledge of the Green Knight. Okay, so that's for me to you. Cool. So the movie, again, was supposed to come out on May 29th, 2020, but I doubt that's going to happen. It's that really cool film company. I think it's called A24, and they made, like, Midsummer and, right, and, like, Pandemic mm-hmm. and stuff. It looks rad. It's very cool.
Yeah.
If that movie doesn't come out, or if you cannot wait until May 29th, there is a very silly movie from 1973 on YouTube that you can watch. It's starring Murray Head as Sir Gawain. And I didn't even realize it was Murray Head because he's so, like, young. And, I mean, he's cute anyway, but, ooh, so strapping. This 1973 movie has the fluffiest bowl cuts I've ever seen. Like, thick, luxurious men's locks and, like, the most loaded looks exchanged. It's ridiculous. I watched the whole thing. I loved it. I hated it. I laughed. I cried. It was great.
That's a real stirring recommendation.
You got come for the fluffy hair and stay for the omission of one of the most important characters, because that's great. All right, well, let's jump in then. So a little bit of background about this. As Jude said, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is an Arthurian story, first and foremost. It is found in a manuscript that was written in the 14th century by an unknown author. We don't know their name. They are known as the Gawain poet or sometimes the Pearl poet. This poet was a contemporary of Geoffrey Chaucer, if that sort of helps you, you know, think about the language and the stuff that was going on at that time. There are a lot of theories about the identity of the author, and everybody's got a hot take, but none are really widely accepted. The author writes in the Northwest Midland dialect of Middle English, and this dialect kind of gives you an idea of where the author was from. There's a British poet and novelist, I think he's also a professor at Oxford, I want to say, Simon Armitage. He's done his own translation of Sir Gawain that came out in 2007. He's like a linguist too and a poet. And he writes, he sort of says that the epicenter of this language is in Cheshire, Staffordshire, and Derbyshire, kind of on the border there. So that kind of gives you some information about where it's from. Basically, this Arthurian story combine some common folk motifs that we find in like early Irish Celtic stuff, such as these beheading games and an exchange of winnings, or like these kind of like games that go down. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I actually hadn't heard of, but I mean, if are there a lot of beheading stories? Because I got to get that book.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there, that's a thing. A lot of the early Arthurian tales have a lot of beheadings. It's very common. I mean, a lot of the early, that yes. I also took a, I also took a class in early, in medieval literature, and it had a lot of stuff from like, not medieval, but like, I don't remember what the exact class description was, but we read stuff like the, and I always butcher this word, the Mabinogion or whatever it's called.
Okay, sure.
It's like a Welsh collection of stories, and yeah, a lot of stuff of that era. And yeah, beheadings are very common. Like,
that's
beheading
awesome.
Games are very common. I don't know about the exchange of winnings. That one's interesting to me. I'm curious to hear more about that.
Yeah.
How that works in.
I mean, don't lose your heads, guys. It's just a story.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, God.
It's going to be a long episode, everybody. Strap in. So this poem about Sir Gawain is found in only one manuscript. It's called Cotton Nero A.X, and it's found with three other religious poems called Pearl, Purity, and Patience. It's believed that all four of these works in this Cotton Nero A.X manuscript were all written by the same person. The Cotton Library. So what is that? That's a weird name. Cotton Nero. Yeah, what's that? The Cotton Library is a collection of manuscripts that were owned by Sir Robert Bruce Cotton, who lived from 1571 to 1631. This dude, Jude, you would have loved him. He was an antiquarian. He was a bibliophile, huge nerd. He loved finding and purchasing old ass manuscripts after the dissolution of the monasteries, like 30 years before he was born. So he kind of hit it right at the right time, you know?
Yeah.
It's a bunch of sad monks trying to sell shit. Like, we can't be monks anymore. Buy my stuff. I don't know. Just peddling shit. No, that's probably not what happened.
Buy my manuscript.
Buy one. Get one free. So the earliest documentation of this particular manuscript is in a library of a man named Henry Saville of Bank. Bank was near Halifax in Yorkshire. But nobody really knows like how it got from Henry to our pal Robert Bruce Cotton. I don't know. My guess is as good as anybody's, I guess. But I'm going to say they won it in a horse race. No, that's not true. Please don't. I'm sorry. Well, skip forward a little while to 1702. Cotton's grandson donates his humongous library to the nation of Britain. And in 1753, Cotton's collection becomes like the base of the British Library. So we can thank him for the tale of Sir Gawain. This name, the Cotton Nero AX, I just thought it was cute because I work in museums and I'm interested in inventories and stuff. That name comes from a numbering system that Cotton devised to organize his library. The manuscript was found under the bust of Nero, so Nero, and then on the top shelf. So for the A, and then the 10th book in on the shelf. So Cotton Nero A.X. It's cute. I like it. We also have Mr. Cotton to thank for the story of Beowulf, because that also came from a manuscript in his collection. And of course, it's another Tolkien favorite. So, dude, thanks, man.
Thank. Yeah, no kidding. That's impressive.
I know. This guy was amazing. So I just want to take you through English class really quick. I know it's kind of boring, but stick with me because it's important, I think. The Green Knight is an example of a Middle English chivalric romance, okay? These were stories that were popular with aristocrats and fancy people in the high medieval and early modern Europe. Basically, it's like a heroic knight goes on a quest and does some stuff. That's the basis of all of these things. This poem is pretty cool because it is written in alliterative verse. So just to remind everybody, an alliteration is the repetition of that initial consonant sound. All of our beautiful, bustling Athrobest listeners should know what an alliteration is because Jude and I usually employ this at the start of our astounding and admirable Athrobest episodes. See what I did nice. There? Yeah. Jude's so mad at me right now. Alliterative verse is a device that uses the alliteration, that double consonant sound, to show an underlying metric structure like within the verse. So the way that someone might use rhyme, you can also use alliteration. Alliterative verse is found in many texts that Tolkien loved, such as the Finnish Kalevala, the Old English story of Beowulf, and the Poetic Edda from Old Norse. So you can see that he was very comfortable with, I mean, you can kind of argue that Tolkien was comfortable with alliterative verse.
You don't even need to argue it. He wrote a great deal of alliterative verse. Like, it's undeniable that he was not just comfortable with it, but it was a style that he was actually very fond of. He wrote his own take on some of the Arthurian tales in alliterative verse. He wrote a buttload of stuff in alliterative verse. I really love alliterative verse, actually. I think it's super, super fun to read out loud. If you have a chance to read this stuff, alliterative verse really is meant to be spoken, not read. I highly recommend all of Tolkien's poetry. I'm going to go off on a little bit of a sidetrack here.
Do it.
Tolkien's poetry is really meant to be done out loud. I took an entire class on Tolkien's poetry, and this was a point that was made repeatedly and one that I always make now when I talk about Tolkien's poetry. I have this mental picture of him like pacing around in the back room of the Bird and, what's it called?
The Bird and the Baby.
With a pipe in one hand, reciting the poetry that will end up in The Lord of the Rings. Because that is, I truly believe how a lot of this poetry that he wrote for those books got written, how he composed it was with those sorts of sessions in mind. But I think it goes deeper than that. I think it goes back to his origins as with his desire to be a poet. I think because he loved the way language sounded, because Tolkien had this very, very profound appreciation for the phonology of a language, the sound of a language, his poetry is really meant to be spoken, be heard out loud. Not all poetry is like that, but his certainly is. And I think that's partially why he loved alliterative verse, because it was designed to be spoken. It was a form of poetry that was meant to be sung or spoken. And I think it really agreed with his aesthetics.
Yeah, that's really cool. I think you're absolutely right. And it is such a joy to listen to Tolkien's version of this out loud. It's amazing.
Yeah.
just one more thing about alliterative verse, for this particular story, it uses this, device called the bobbin wheel, which is like a two metric scheme where I don't really understand what it is, 'cause I'm not an English person, but like an English studying person, Jesus, you can tell, yikes. But
even though you are in fact like, English,
I don't speak English. I don't, it's hard. The wheel is the meat and the potatoes, and then there's like a little two syllable bob endy bit at the end. So if you actually look at it on the page, you can kind of tell it's got that rhythm to it. I'll just mention too that I didn't put this in the outline, but a lot of people, a lot of scholars, you know, take their hat off to this original poet who wrote this, because alliterative verse is hard to write. And this dude or dudette or whoever they were wrote like 2,000 lines of alliterative verse. It's quite a thing that they accomplished. So even if you don't like the language or you don't like the story, like the fact that it was written so beautifully, kind of shows the mastery over that form. So it's kind of cool. I just want to talk to you about this idea of like an addition of this versus a translation of this, because you see these words sometimes used interchangeably, and mm-hmm. I'm still not really sure what people mean, but basically it's really hard to do a word for word translation of this sort of Middle English poetry, because some of the words like that were used by the original poet are just not in used in English anymore. I mentioned the poet Simon Armitage. Yeah, he gives this example of the word lemd, which is comes from an old Norse word, lioma, which basically means like to shine. So there's a light, there's a line that says, by that any daylight lemd upon earth. Armitage is kind of arguing that this use of this word lemd instead of the word shine is, it's used specifically because of the poetry behind the word. It's onomatopoeic in nature. It would have been more evocative for the listener at the time. But, you know, we don't use that. That word doesn't exist anymore for us.
Yeah.
So there's a difference there. A translation versus an addition. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, the other thing that makes it hard is one of the other poetic devices that is very common in alliterative verse is what's called kennings.
Mm-hmm.
Which is where the one that I always like to give the example of is that I think is from Beowulf, is where they refer to the ocean as the whale's road.
Wow.
And this is where, in order to make it fit into, and it's not like that's it's uncommon for poetry to use metaphor, but it's a very specific thing that is done in alliterative verse in order to make it to hit those alliterative things. You'll replace a word with a like a metaphor or like a reference or something like that, like calling calling the ocean the whale's road, and it makes translation very difficult because there's a lot of artistry in these kennings, so direct translation is impossible. Like that one works. But there are a lot of them that only work in their native language. And
that's really
so
cool.
Direct translation just doesn't work. So then what do you translate then? If translating the kenning doesn't work, what do you do?
Yeah. Where does it leave you?
I think that's super cool. I always thought that was really fascinating. I think that's one of the reasons I actually really like alliterative verse, is I think that I think it sounds really cool, and I think that method of fitting the verse together using the sort of artistic license for language, any of you who have heard me talk for any amount of time will know I tend to take some creative liberties with the English language, so that speaks to me on a pretty deep level. So,
yeah, and Tolkien definitely agreed with you in that. Mm-hmm. Just to give you a little background about Tolkien's involvement in this work, Tolkien started working on this in 1925 while he was teaching at Leeds University. He worked with another philologist and his friend, E.V. Gordon, or Eric Valentine Gordon, and together they wrote an edition of this. Christopher Tolkien has since noted that this edition was mostly all of Gordon's work, and Tolkien kind of wrote the introduction for it. In 1936, the text was corrected by them, but unfortunately, E.V. Gordon died in 1938, and Tolkien never finished the piece. There is a second edition of this, of Tolkien and Gordon's work. It was edited by Norman Davis. He is the guy who succeeded Tolkien as the professor of English language and literature at Merton College in Oxford, so he knows this stuff. Davis's work was published in 1967. And then Tolkien himself died in 1973, and his translation was left unpublished, unfortunately. So then, of course, our wonderful, amazing person who we owe so much to, Christopher Tolkien, steps into the story. Tolkien's Allen and Unwin edition of The Green Knight was later published in 1975, so a couple years after he passed away. It was edited by Chris Tolkien, and the book contains two other poems, Pearl, which I had already mentioned as being by the Pearl poet, and Sir Orfeo. There's an introduction to this publication that's written by Christopher Tolkien, and he said that his father really wanted to see these published so that they could be enjoyed not only by first-time readers of the story, but also by scholars who maybe have even done their own translation. He really seemed like he wanted it to just be another version in the pool.
He was a big old nerd for that stuff, so that makes sense to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Christopher writes in his introduction that he really wanted to keep his own commentaries out of the edition. He really wanted his father's commentaries to kind of take center stage. Chris also wrote that, you know, there is an introduction by J.R.R. Tolkien in this version. Chris tells us that this was taken partly from Tolkien's notes and partly from a radio talk that Tolkien gave when his edition was presented on the radio. Christopher notes that he had to figure out which of Tolkien's translations and writings were sort of the most recent in the stack of versions. And this should sound very familiar to all of us who love Tolkien, because, of course, Chris had to do this for many of Tolkien's posthumous publications, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Arguably, that was one of the great skills he learned in his life's projects was understanding his father's the chronology of his father's work.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I mean, I just want to give another shout out. It's thanks to Christopher Tolkien that we have this beautiful piece. So thank you, bro.
Yeah.
Let's see. So after Chris's, I feel like I'm being very overly familiar by calling him Chris. Sorry. Christopher's introduction goes first, and then there is this introduction by J.R.R. Tolkien. He sort of talks about the manuscript itself and discusses like what you can glean about the author based on the works within. And then he sort of states what he thinks the poem is really about. Like, what's the underlying message in the story? One thing I love in this introduction is Tolkien kind of mentions that, like, even in his own time, which is the 14th century, the author of this, the language that he uses, the grammar, the style, the vocabulary, all of this would have seemed very remote to, like, the hip folks in London. Remember that the author, we can surmise that the author was a northerner. I feel like maybe he and Tolkien were, like, nerds akin on the same wavelength a little bit here. Tolkien talks about the alliterative meter of the poem, and he states that this is a very ancient English form, even when it was employed by the author. So it would have sounded kind of harsh to those who are more familiar with like the syllabic, beautiful, rhythmically pleasing poems that were coming out of France and Chaucer's work at the time, right? This would have seemed a little readier to them because it was ancient even in the 14th century. Tolkien kind of chuckles and says, like, there was an attempted revival at alliterative verse in the 14th century, but you can kind of see that it wasn't super successful because we really know nothing about this author. It didn't really get off the ground.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of funny. And Tolkien basically says that this translation of this poem is necessary because, right, in the way that it is, if you just read it, it's really only, like, understandable to medieval specialists, and that's not good enough because it's worthwhile and everybody should be able to read and enjoy it. He notes that his main aim in this translation was to preserve the meter, which is, as Jude said, are like so essential to the poems. And he really wanted to present the language as it was meant to be understood at the time, which I thought was kind of neat. He believed that the story is like a good tale on the surface, but that there's quite a bit more to it. It's an underlying morality story that the author is sort of imposing on this, on these characters, which are pretty blatant, I would say, after reading it. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. That's how it should be. That's what it was meant to do. And but it definitely hits you in the face, I think. Tolkien states, so the author of this, of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, made this knight sort of the ideal of Christianity, in which the knight's chivalry and courtesy is divined from the most courteous one of all, the Virgin Mary. Tolkien even calls her Heaven's Courteous Queen, like, in the text. Sir Gawain is, like, so into the Virgin Mary. He, like, prays to her a couple of times for her help, and he even has an image of her painted on the inside of his shield so that he can be reminded of her, like, at all times, which is kind of cool. It's kind of neat.
It's a little intense.
It's a lot, but, you know, it was a different
It's like the nerd that keeps the picture of the popular girl on the inside of his locker.
How did you see my locker? Leave me alone. So Tolkien says that basically this divinity that the author is talking about is like very clearly demonstrated in Sir Gawain. He wears a pentangle instead of a lion or an eagle, which you like what you would normally see on shields and stuff. This pentangle is an ancient Christian symbol for the five wounds of Christ. The pentangle also represents like a never-ending and interconnected set of ideals, right? It never ends. There's no start or stopping point. And these ideals are very important to Sir Gawain. Tolkien says that Sir Gawain's valor kind of comes from these five joys, and they are free giving, so being a person who gives freely, friendliness all the time without hesitation, chastity, chivalry, and piety. The author is presenting his own moral ideals by showcasing these ideals incarnate in a living person, Gawain. It's kind of cool. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I can get down with all those things. Maybe, well, okay, never mind. I was going to make a comment, but I've, Jude's laughing.
Yeah.
Cool. Let's move on. Basically, in this story, the author is showing us that there's a complication in the matters of like conduct and courtly behavior towards women versus the fidelity and like the sportsmanship that you would show towards men. This story kind of shows how these ideas of sin and virtue are interrelated and sometimes like at odds with each other. Gawain has like a deep sense of his own honor. He takes a lot of pride in his honor, and this makes his struggle really real. Tolkien says, yeah, that like Gawain is trying to like reject sin in lieu of virtue, but he doesn't totally do that. And that makes him like super real as a character, right?
Yeah.
The struggle is real. Poor Gawain. He's fine. Basically, he has, and then in the end, he has to bear the shame for the rest of his life. And he chooses to do that. He's kind of grappling with, like, how do I preserve proper conduct and courtesy while staying true to my Christian values, such as, like, marital fidelity, right, in the case of this story. And Tolkien's view of the author's point is basically that the grace obtained by prayer that then is, like, wait, let me start that over. Tolkien's view of the author's point is that through grace obtained by prayer, the knight can refuse sin and temptation that's kind of thrown at him in the guise of courtesy. And that all sounds a bit like, what? But don't worry, we're going to get to it when we get in the story. But before that, I just want to stress two things. Okay, anybody who's listened to this podcast knows that Jude and I are a big fan of John Garth. Right?
We stand John Garth.
We always have to mention John Garth.
Yeah.
So he wrote that amazing book that we love, Tolkien and the Great War, The Threshold of Middle-earth. And in that book, John Garth notes that Tolkien was very passionate about medieval literature. And Garth states that, you know, even Tolkien himself wrote to his friends that he was more comfortable writing in the ancient and middle style than that of like the modern style. And that's kind of what you were saying, right, Jude? This is something that he was very comfortable with and he preferred.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that notion is very perfectly exemplified in this work and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. As Jude said, like, if you read it out loud, it is such a joy to hear the words. You can hear Tolkien like having fun with it. It is beautiful, and it's totally worth checking that out, like, not just on the page, but in the ear as well.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing to say.
No, that, yeah, I really, if Tolkien is writing poetry, I can't recommend enough that you read it out loud.
Yeah.
It will increase your enjoyment of it significantly. No matter how silly you feel reading poetry out loud.
Totally. Get a lute or something. It'll make you feel better. Get some pantaloons, right, Jude? I mean, and that's the other point that I just kind of wanted to call out. I just want to remind everyone that Tolkien really was a poet at heart. Again, John Garth writes that Tolkien didn't really write a ton of poetry before the Great War, but he notes that like the pressure of completing his degree, like with the onset of war at the same time, kind of drove Tolkien to poetry, in his opinion, and that lots of the early legendarium are written in poetic forms. So again, like if you think about the time period that he was doing this in, it all kind of makes some sense. Why do I bring this up? I don't know. Many people translate Sir Gawain and the Green Knight and they look for like historical connections and he wants the translation to really focus on the story. But I think Tolkien's work is different. It's poetic. It's beautiful. It's playful. And it was awesome. So I'm full disclosure. When I started this, I didn't realize it was the poem. I don't know what I thought it was, but I was like, I started reading it and I was like to my husband, James, this is poetry. Joan's making me read poetry. I was so mad. By the end, I really liked
In fairness, I did not make you read poetry. You volunteered to read poetry. This is a project of your own undertaking.
That's true. He's right.
Can't blame this one on me.
I'm busted. I did choose to read it, but I didn't realize I was opting for poetry. So, yeah. All right. Let me tell you the story. I'm going to tell you the 5-minute version of this story. It's great for those of you who have not read it. Okay. If you want to see the movie and not either the 1973 version or the sexy Dev Patel version, hey, maybe skip ahead like 6 minutes. And those of you who want to hear it, let's do it. Are you ready? We open. It's Christmas time in King Arthur's court. Can you hear the jovial sounds of the Yuletide, Jude?
I'm going to put some, some Yuletide jovial sounds over on the edit right there.
Little jingle bells and people cheersing and saying huzzah, because I assume they say huzzah. So Arthur, his sexy wife Guinevere, his knight bros, a couple of nephews, some family members, they're sitting around, chilling out, maxing, relaxing, all cool. As one does during the Christmas time. And in comes this green giant knight guy. He's big. He's green. He's on a giant green horse, which I mean, you had me at giant green horse. You know me, I love horses.
I do.
He has this like huge bushy green beard. He has this hair that like goes all the way down to his waist or like, yeah, the middle of his arms. It's super long. He's just got a lot of stuff going on. There is a beautiful section where Tolkien describes the sumptuous clothes that the knight is wearing. They're all like interwoven with gold wire. It sounds like really great. He carries this like giant green axe and he comes in and he's like, what's up, you guys? Hey, I'm going to challenge you to a game. You guys want to play a game? Who wants to play a game? Anybody? Anybody? Everybody is silent. Nobody is interested in this. Everyone's just wondering, like, who is this weird fairy man? It's, you know. He seems like a pretty nice dude, though. So let's see. This is the game.
I think I want to pause you just 1 second.
Please.
You refer to him as a fairy man, right?
Yeah. In the book, he says is he a fae man?
Yeah. So
that's kind of interesting.
This is a thing that I think gets overlooked in a lot of translations of this. Maybe not overlooked, but like a lot of people... A lot of translations, and I think a lot of people focus on the like knightly aspect of this. And I think one of the things that Tolkien really liked about this, unsurprisingly, is that this is a fairy tale.
Yeah.
This is a fairy story. And it adheres to, as we go on, you'll see, it adheres to a lot of the tropes of fairy stories. As well as like these knightly chivalry tales, but it also adheres to these fairy tale tropes, which I think Tolkien really appreciated.
Yeah, absolutely. Right in that same section, they're talking about how big he is, and they say the mightiest on Middle Earth in measure of height. And I was like, "What Middle Earth? Oh my God!" I don't, you know, not quite the same place, yeah. But I was into it. It's pretty cool. Yeah. All right, so this big jovial guy with nice clothes, a big horse, a big bushy beard comes in and is like, I got a game for you guys. Here's the game. One of you knights can like deal me a blow, and then in 1 year's time, I'm going to deal you that same blow back. All right? Who's in for it? And everyone's like, I'm sorry, what? What did you say? It seems questionable to me, right?
I can't figure out what the margin here is. Like, why would you agree to this?
Because if you dealt him a good enough blow and you kill him, then you don't have to get the blow back, right?
Yeah, I guess that's the game, is you, if you just kill him outright, you win.
Right.
seems like a dumb game to me.
I mean, I completely agree. It's not even a game. It's like, oh, do you ever have to go? Have you ever been to a dinner party where they force you to play a party game? Yes, because I've thrown those dinner parties for you. And yes. I have forced you to play party games and nobody likes them. They're horrible. They are painful. And I don't know why I continue. I don't know.
Anyway. It's like a machismo thing, obviously. It's like, yeah, you know.
Yes, like who's going to step up? Who's going to who's going to be a man and do this with me, right? Well, all of the knights are super silent. There's like this weird moment where they're all kind of like, I don't know. And Arthur's kind of pressured into being like, all right, I guess I'll do it. So he like gets down and he takes the axe. And it's at this point where his nephew, Sir Gawain, stands up from the table and is like, no. I'm kind of like the lamest one here. I'm kind of weenie. I should just do it. Like, obviously you're not going to do it. I'll do it. Like if I died, who really cares? Right. So poor Gawain, whatever. The important thing to keep in mind here is that in this time period, a person's word was everything. And this idea of like chivalry and loyalty and honesty was super important. So if Gawain, you know, or anyone says, I'll come and find you in a year so you can deal me a blow that I dealt you. And but then not show up, like that's a big problem. He would lose a lot of face. It's like the worst thing you could do. So if a participant gives their word that they're going to do it, they're going to do it. Right.
Yeah.
So the knight's like, sweet, let's do this. And he even like bends down and parts his hair and shows his neck to Sir Gawain. Sir Gawain's like, hell yeah, I'm doing this. And he uses the guy's axe and he chops the Green Knight's head off and blood spurts out and it's bleh. And there's lots of great language. And the head rolls on the floor, like down the aisle. And weirdly enough, instead of dying, the Green Knight is like, meep, boop, boop. He picks up his head, holds it by the hair and is like, cool, brah. I'll see you in the Green Chapel in 1 year. Goodbye to you. And that's it. Everyone's like, oh my God, he's not dead. Oh shit. What are we going to do? All right. Well, a year passes super quickly, and it's time for Gawain to set off in search of the Green Chapel and the Green Knight. He dresses in that, as I said, that cool five-pointed star, the pentangle. And there's like this really weird scene of him like putting on all of his, you know, accoutrement. He wears like a fancy red outfit. Hey-o. And he goes riding in the countryside. He's got this great horse named Gringalot. Oh, crap. I forgot the horse's name. Whatever. Somebody corrections cul-de-sac me. rides through the countryside. He sleeps on the ground. It kind of sounds not great. He, like, goes to northern Wales. He crosses a river. It's not the best trip, okay? It's not great. Some scholars will point out the great Gawain is like wrestling with his own fears and his own conscience in this time. He prays to the Virgin Mary for help. And he sees this like because it's kind of getting close to New Year when he needs to show up for this meeting with the Green Knight. Right. And he hasn't found him yet. He's like, oh, my God, it's Christmas Eve. Mary, please. You like praise to Jesus and to Saint somebody. And he's like, please give me a place where I can see Mass tomorrow, because that would be great. I would love that instead of sleeping outside. I really like that. And the next day, he's riding around in the forest and he sees a castle on the horizon. And he's like, hell yeah, I'm going to that castle. So he rides out to this castle, and this castle is owned by a man named Bertilac. He's like super nice. He's very loud. He does a lot of yelling. I would know nothing about this. He has a huge bushy red beard. He immediately invites Sir Gawain to stay, which is great. When we meet Bertilac, we also meet his super hot wife, hey, and this kind of not very hot old crone lady at the same time. So Gawain tells Bertilac, cool, I gotta find this like Green Chapel by New Year's Day. I gotta face the Green Knight. And Bertilac's like, bro, you came to the right place. It's really close to here. You can totally hang out here for 3 days and three nights and you can still make your meeting. And Gawain's like, all right, cool. Let's do it. Bertilac's like, all right, I'm gonna go hunting tomorrow. You should hang out in here and rest. But why don't we do our own little side game? Here's a cool game. Everyone's into games in this frickin'. I guess this is that game thing we were talking about earlier. He says this, I will give you whatever I win during my hunt if you give me whatever you win during your day at the castle. And Gawain's like, deal, let's do it. So then the next day we have the scene of Birdlack and his bros, and they go hunting and they catch a deer. And we also see interlaced with this a scene of Gawain kind of like waking up, being awoken by Birdlack's sexy wife. Hey, she comes in, she's seducing him, and she's like, teach me about your lovemaking, blah, 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 blah. And Gawain's like, no, no, thank you. And she's like, but what, are you going to like deny me a kiss? And he's like, hey, if you want to give me a kiss, I will obey. And she's like, great, I'm going to give you a kiss. So they kiss because he doesn't want to seem rude. Remember, he's all about chivalry and like courtly behavior. So they do this thing. Birdlack comes back. He gives Gawain this venison from the hunt. And he's like, and what did you get? And Gawain gives him a big old kiss. And Birdlack's like, damn, dude, I want to know what you got up to today. And Gawain's like, oh, that's not the deal. I gave you what I got. I don't have to tell you where I got it from. And he's like, ha, true. Ha, ha, ha. And they laugh and feast. So
point of interest.
Yes.
I have a question about courtly behavior.
Oh, please.
So is it, what made the kiss okay but nothing else? Is it that he did not like resist? He didn't have to do any act. It was passive.
I think that's exactly right. Cause I think he says like,
I'm just saying there's other things that she could have done. That would have been a little more awkward to pass along.
It's true, but I think you're right. I think it's very much like his own morality and like, I don't want to, remember, he's all about friendliness above all and like free giving stuff and like being cool. But at the same time, he's like, okay, so I don't want to seem rude. So I guess if you really want me to do it, if you ask me.
Well, I'm not
going to
make this segment blue. I'm just saying she could have gone a lot further than a kiss.
Hey-o!
I feel like it wouldn't have crossed the passivity line that he apparently is using to justify that kiss.
I'm into it. And like Tolkien, it's not very sexy in Tolkien's adaptation.
I'm mostly making a goof out of it.
Well,
you
shouldn't, because in Armitage's, when you hear Simon Armitage, who also has this version from 2007, he's very much like, oh, he's so passionate, and he's like a sexy knight, and it's much more than Tolkien. So I think you're right. It could have been a little sexier. Personally, for me, I could have got, let's go sexier. I'm always about it. Let's turn it up.
Yeah, I don't think I'm necessarily advocating that it could have gone sexier so much as I'm simply pointing out that the rules by which Gawain is justifying the kiss as not breaking any of his rules.
Totes.
Seems dubious. It feels like that's a legal loophole. That's a really big loophole through which he could have fit, you know, some hand stuff or second base or, you know, quite a bit more.
Yes, I think you're right. Well, let's check back in with them on day two. So day two, Birdlack goes hunting again with his dudes and they kill a wild boar. Gawain at the same time is staying home with and just relaxing, and he's visited by the little sexy wife lady again while he's still in bed, and she tries to seduce him a second time, and he gives and they exchange a second kiss, and he feels like, okay, I'm kind of warding her off, I'm allowing her to save face. Cool. In the evening, Birdlack comes back, gives Gawain like a boar meat sandwich, I don't know, and Birdlack gets a big old kiss from
boring cheese.
Chingale. They get a little kiss in return. And then they eat and feast and it's great. So you can see there's a theme forming here. A lot of scholars will point out that these hunt scenes that are kind of interlaced with these like sexy bedroom scenes are like this direct parallel, you know? On the third day, Birdlack goes hunting again. He kills a fox. At the same time, Birdlack's wife comes into Gawain's room and offers, and she's like, yes, kiss, it's your last day. You have to leave tomorrow to go do your thing. Blah, da, blue, I don't know. She's like, here, have a gift of a ring. And Gawain's like, well, actually, she first asks Gawain for a present. And he's like, yeah, I don't have any. Lady, what? I was in a forest. I don't have anything. What are you talking about? And she's like, okay, I will give you this beautiful jeweled ring. And he's like, no, that's too fancy. Don't give me that. And she's like, okay, fine. How about this green girdle, which is also sometimes referred to as like a sash or a belt. It's just like a piece of green fabric. And Gawain's like, no, I don't really want that. But then the lady is kind of like, you're going to not take my fancy gift? Come on. Is it not nice enough for you now? Jeez. Then finally he says, okay, fine, I'll take it. Because Birdlack's wife, it says, hey, if you're wearing the girdle, it's magic. If you're wearing it, you cannot be harmed. Like, you can't be killed. And Gawain's like, all right, sweet, I will take that. But she says, don't tell my husband about this gift, okay? And he's like, all right. And then, of course, they have a sexy third kiss. So in the evening, Birdlack comes back, hands over the fox, and Gawain gives him a kiss. But Gawain does not give him the green sash, thus breaking their arrangement. Yeah. Oh, shit. Cue the air horns. Things are about to get wah, crazy,
wah,
Jude.
Wah, wah.
Wow, that was a sad horn. It was like a sad trombone. So the next morning, time for Gawain to head to the Green Chapel. The servant dude goes with him and is like, bro, you don't have, if you go down there, that guy's going to fucking murder you. Don't go. You, if you leave, I won't tell anybody. And Gawain's like, no, I got to go. It's the honorable thing. I got to do it. Blah, blah, blah. So they go down into this Green Chapel, which is like this very, it's like a gorge, very leafy, green, nature-y kind of place. And he goes down there and he hears this scary sound. It's the Green Knight sharpening the axe blade. And the Green Knight is like, hey, you showed up. What's up, dude? Cool. Let's do this. I get to behead you now. And Gawain's like, oh, crap salad. All right. Green Knight tries three times to behead Gawain. The first time he swings the axe, Gawain's like, ah, and he flinches, which, okay, I'll give him that. I don't want to get beheaded either.
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, right? The second time, the Green Knight misses. He, like, biffs it. And then the third time, the Green Knight gets him. But he gives him only, like, a little flesh wound with some blood coming out. Nothing too bad. So that's good. And at this point, Gawain's like, all right, I've kept up my end of the bargain. Fuck this shit. I'm out of here. And the Green Knight's like, oh, my God, guess what, though? I'm Birdlack from the castle. It's me. See, I have a beard and he had a beard. Ah, see what I did there? And poor Gawain is like, what the fuck? What? What do you mean you're Birdlack? Okay, so Birdlack explains that he has been transformed into the Green Knight by a character who we really haven't heard a lot about until right now, a lady named Morgan Le Fay. That's that old crone lady who we met with Gawain when Gawain entered the castle and he met the hot, sexy wife. Remember I mentioned there was an old, ugly lady? That was her. Jude is not. He doesn't care. But it's important. Morgan Le Fay is important. This is all we hear of her, but she did this. So the Green Knight slash Birdlack says that this whole thing was Morgan's idea to kind of fuck with the Knights of the Round Table and suss him out and scare the dickens out of Guinevere for some fucking reason. I don't know. Well, I guess they don't like each other. The Green Knight slash Birdlack also says, like, hey, bro, I know about the seduction attempts of my wife, and I know that she gave you that green girdle, and I know that you cheated on our game and you didn't tell me the truth. And at this point, Gawain's like, oh, my God, I feel so bad. I'm sorry. Oh, he felt terrible. He was hiding the green girdle the whole time. The Green Knight's like, ah, don't worry about it, bro. You're good. We're cool. He's like, I've sussed you out. You're a cool dude. We're fine. No worries. Gawain still feels bad, though. And he's like, all right, I'm going to wear this green sash as a sign of my shame. And the Green Knight's like, all right, bring it in. They hug it out and then they part ways. Gawain goes back to King Arthur's court and tells the tale, shows them like the notch in his neck and tells them about his dishonesty. Arthur and the Knight Bros like freaking love the story. They all decide we're going to wear a green sash of our own in solidarity and brotherhood forever on. And that is the end of the story. Whew. Fuck, that was a little longer than 6 minutes.
A little bit.
So, okay, cool. That's what the story is. Now, you need to know the story or else nothing from here on will make sense to you. All right. So now that we know the story of the Green Knight, I want to talk a little bit about how this is connected to the legendarium. There's a lot of scholarly work that's been done that connects this story to Tolkien's Legendarium, right? While prepping for this episode, I found all kinds of good stuff, but this one article really interested me, and I want to present that work to you because I think it's a really interesting link. It is called Galadriel and Morgan Le Fay, Tolkien's Redemption of the Lady of the Lacuna by Susan Carter. It was published in Mythlore, Volume 25, Number 304. In the spring summer of 2007. So in this paper, Carter is stating that this Lady of the Lacuna, in quotes, and Lacuna means like a gap or an unfilled space, that this Lady of Lacuna is a literary type in and of itself. Carter believes that Tolkien was influenced by the character of Morgan Le Fay in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight for his character of none other than Galadriel.
Interesting.
Which is kind of cool. I know. In this
article, I'm curious. Yeah, I'm very interested to see where this is going.
Sure. So Carter explores women's abilities to influence events and characters without being specifically called out. And she makes the point that it's their ambiguity that makes them really effective. Morgan Le Fay is obviously the baddie in this story, right, of Sir Gawain. She's a very negative character. But Carter argues that Galadriel redeems this motif of the absent female agent. That's what I'm going to tell you about. So just to remind us, Morgan Le Fay, old ugly lady, fucked everybody over. She's the reason why we're having all these problems, right? Mm-hmm. She is a great agent of power. It's said that when he first meets her, in Tolkien's translation, he says like, it's obvious that she has the respect of all the men at court. Again, we don't directly see any of this power at all. Like, that's the thing. Like, you can pretty much, and some people do, leave Morgan Le Fay, like, out of your story completely, and it doesn't do that much to it. But she is, like, the whole reason for the story existing.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Galadriel is our beautiful elven queen. She is suggestively very powerful. But again, like Morgan, her authority kind of remains unclear. Carter argues that Morgan Le Fay and Galadriel are similar and that we don't really know what they're doing, but their magic feels really big and also like a little bit sinister at times. In Sir Gawain, we really don't see much of Morgan, but in the end, she's revealed by the Green Knight to be the one that's responsible for this whole thing. She set this up to trick the knights and to like teach them a lesson, to kind of size them up. And Gawain's like, man, women really suck. Which is not the best, but okay, fine. Carter points out that Morgan remains pretty mysterious, but her presence is there. Even at the end of the story, when Gawain and his like bros leave, Gawain still has that sash. He's still carrying something that's imbued with Morgan's power. Again, she's like this important character that we don't really see much of. Carter points out that this idea of magic containing dark powers is also found in our pal Galadriel. We know Galadriel's called different variations of like the Lady of the Wood by multiple characters in The Lord of the Rings. Gimli, Éomer, they all call her the Lady of the Wood, the Mistress of the Wood. Legolas talks about Lothlorien, you know, a place that's under her domain being called like the Golden Wood. Our pal Faramir, it's like, oh man, if you deal with the Mistress of Magic, things are going to get crazy, yo. Carter is just trying to point out that Galadriel's this wood-dwelling figure of purity, but she retains this kind of weird, sinister side due to her authority and her aloofness. Faramir is very fearful of Galadriel's magic, and he sort of implies that maybe her power pushed Boromir to his death. In Book 4, Chapter 5, The Window on the West, Faramir is talking to Frodo about like how they knew Boromir, right? It's like when they're talking about the belt. Pulled up my thing. Sorry. They're talking about the belt. And he sort of has this moment of pain and sadness where he's talking to Boromir and he says, what did she say to you, the lady that dies not? What did she see? What woke in your heart then, right? It's sowing some seeds of like, ooh, like worry a little bit.
Yeah.
Other of Galadriel's powers, right? She summons the White Council. She wields one of the Elven Rings. She gives these gifts that end up saving their recipients. She sort of has this like pre-knowledge of epic events, and she can kind of see beyond the bounds of time with her spiffy mirror. She's a very, very powerful character, but it's very much downplayed. Carter says that Morgan and Galadriel are similar and that their magic is never fully revealed. Carter argues that the lacuna around Morgan, and I love this quote, the puzzle generated by her veiled agency. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah, that, and she's saying that that lacuna, that weird, like, missing piece is a trope in its own right. Galadriel, too, is a character who, she says, quote, her power is heightened by mystery. I love that. So many authors also draw similarities between Galadriel and deities from Celtic stories, from fairy queens and so forth. And Carter states that these connections often overlap with connections that are also made to Morgan le Fay. So you've got this sort of Venn diagram of similarities between all of these sort of lady.
Gotcha.
These like authoritative lady figures. But what's really interesting, Carter says that Tolkien translates all that's kind of crappy and dark and evil about Morgan into like light and hope and beauty in this character of Galadriel. So then Carter kind of goes on to say, like, yeah, Morgan is like one of the weirdest parts of this story of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. When the Green Knight reveals that he's Bertilac at the end, we kind of have these questions and we get like zero details. We ask ourselves, like, is Bertilac a spirit? Is he like the spirit of nature? Or is he just like a mortal dude who got shapeshifted? We have no idea. None of this is really answered. I just wanted to read, if you're okay with me, just I'm going to read the section in which the Green Knight describes Morgan.
Yeah.
He says, Bertilac de Howe Desert, hereabouts I am called. Who thus have been enchanted and changed in my hue by the might of Morgan le Fay that in my mansion dwelleth, and by cunning of lore and crafts well learned. The magic arts of Merlin she many hath mastered, for deeply in dear love she dealt on a time with that accomplished clerk, as at Camelot runs the fame, and Morgan the goddess is therefore now her name. None power and pride possess too high for her to tame. So I thought that was kind of cool. You get a little bit of that alliteration in there. That's from Tolkien's version. Beautiful. Yeah, she's just a huge weird question mark in this story.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's kind of like galling to Sir Gawain and the Green Knight that really Morgan le Fay is responsible for this whole thing. This whole quest came from female influence, not from like men, like honorable masculine kind of throwing down. It's really like this like feminine challenge to the masculine elite, and that makes this whole thing kind of vexatious to Sir Gawain and to the Green Knight, and it also makes it kind of playful to the reader. Carter states that Tolkien, you know, perhaps constructed Galadriel in this same way, that it's really only when we reach the end of the tale that the reader kind of like revisits Galadriel and reconsiders her role as like more central than you saw in first reading, right? Because she's standing there at the end when they sail to the Grey Havens and you're like, oh my God, she's amazing. I don't know. I think she's pretty cool.
No, I get that. I like that a lot, actually. I think it's interesting that her influence is unseen and yet moves the entire story. That's a really interesting trope to me.
Yeah.
That lacuna trope. That's super cool. And I do think the parallels between her and Galadriel are super interesting. And I wonder, I wish there was more information on how purposeful that was, because I do think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think a lot. I mean, this is us. This is Carter kind of pulling this out of the text. I'm sure you could argue differently, but I just loved it. So, So just to kind of keep going a little bit, in book 2, chapter 7 of The Lord of the Rings, called The Mirror of Galadriel, this is that point where Galadriel is sizing up each member of the Fellowship. And it's really, and it says that it really makes them feel very uneasy. The quote is, all of them, it seemed, had fared alike. Each had felt he was offered a choice between a shadow full of fear that lay ahead and something that he greatly desired. Clear before his mind it lay, and to get it he had only to turn aside from the road and leave the quest and the war against Sauron to others. So it's like she's sort of asking them to choose between uncertainty and death and their own desires, right? And Carter makes the point that this choice is very important. It's a great central theme to The Lord of the Rings, right? Personal sacrifice for the common good. And again, from this incident, we see some distrust being sown. Boromir tells the group, "I do not feel too sure of this elvish lady and her purposes." This is making the reader very wary of her, and it's really only later that she's revealed as like kind of to be on the side of the heroes. I think her ambiguity really pays off in this moment. So a couple other Morgan and Galadriel similarities. They both enter their respective stories about a third of the way in, and they both accompany people who are kind of seem to be more important than them, but they're actually not. So Galadriel is with her husband Celeborn, who's sort of assumed by the reader to be the greater power. Morgan is the same. She enters the story as this like old ugly lady who's holding the hand of this like hot, super sexy young wife. She's got like a big butt, they say. That's cool. Whatever, so don't we all, right? She provides this perfect backdrop of, like, the hottest lady that Cawain has ever seen. And in her first... What?
Interesting. I didn't pick up on that detail. I don't remember that big butt part. That's funny.
I know, it's so funny. It's, hold on. Let me read it. It says, bloop, 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 short of body and thick waist... with bulging buttocks spread and more delicious to the taste was the one she by her led. So, okay, whatever. Listen, we all got big butts. It's coronavirus. Leave us alone. It's fine. But anyway, it's supposed to present this duality, right? Again, we even in her first appearance, we get these clues that Galadriel is very independent and maybe you could argue superior to Celeborn, right? She gives off, yeah. She's very tall. She has this very low voice. She's giving these sort of masculine, vibes off a little bit in some ways, right? She has all this info for things that she wasn't like there for. She makes all these clever deductions. She's pretty cool when we first meet her, but also kind of like, well, I don't trust her. Meet Morp. Then Carter kind of introduces this idea of the loathly lady. Carter states that Morgan le Fay mirrors this trope of the ugly hag that we find in a lot of Irish folk stories and mythology, referred to as the loathly lady. So the loathly lady, these stories are basically about these shape-shifting ladies who teach men all about kingship. So, yeah. All right, great. In these tales, an ugly lady teaches the male hero and basically transforms him to power while at the same time transforms herself into like a beautiful hot lady. Really, this character's role is to like re-educate the male character, and in doing so, she redeems him. In Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, Sir Gawain is taught this really hard lesson about his own failings, right? This lesson about honor from the actions of Morgan le Fay, who is working through the Green Knight. Gawain and Bertilek are sort of cleared at the end of any of their wrongdoings, because really at the end it was Morgan and Bertilek's wife who were like in on it and did the misdeeds and tricked Gawain. And this absolution of the male characters kind of provides them this happy ending, which really fits into this loathly lady trope. Carter argues that Tolkien, you know, would have been aware that the figures, these female figures, in Sir Gawain, Morgan and the Bertilek's wife lady, their duality of ugliness and beauty, their like their temptation and the challenge that they pose, they are serving as like these blame repositories, right? They're the reason why all this happened. The idea of the shape-shifting loathly lady is found in two people in this particular story, but in Lord of the Rings, we see this loathly lady in the form of one character. And Carter thinks that this duality in, you know, within this character enriches, and of course we're talking about Galadriel, it's enriching her character because we really see these two sides of her. That's the thing. Galadriel has a very sinister side. At that moment when Frodo offers her the ring, Galadriel describes the corruption that would take place, right? Book 2,
that's
chapter
a great
7.
Scene.
Yeah, we get that beautiful... actually, Dr. Feamy, if you're listening to this episode when it comes out, like not long ago, Dr. Feamy quote, like tweeted this out, that this is like something she can recite from heart. She doesn't have to read it to know it. And I love that. Now I want to memorize it too, because that's cool.
It's a good quote.
Yeah. So the quote is, "And now at last it comes, you give me the ring freely. In place of the Dark Lord, you will set up a queen, and I shall not be dark, but beautiful and terrible as the morning and the night. As fair as the sea and the sun and the snow upon the mountain, dreadful as the storm and the lightning, stronger than the foundations of the earth, all shall love me and despair." Like, whoa, what? That's crazy. That's a big moment.
That's an intense quote.
Absolutely. Carter is arguing that Galadriel is really exemplifying the duality of the loathly lady, who typically embodies, you know, things that are both terrible and good about the idea of control and the idea of kingship.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. There's also like the one, you know, one thing that the lowly lady does in these, like that trope, she is a kingmaker, right? She makes people into kings. That's her whole thing. So Galadriel, Carter argues, is also sort of filling this role, this king-making function, because she gives Aragorn the Elfstone at a point in the story when he's still unidentified as the future king. And, of course, she gives it to him on behalf of Arwen, but if you remember from, like, the writings about Aragorn, it was foretold that Galadriel would be the one to give it to the person who is, like, the one who is meant to have it, whose name was actually written on it. So it's kind of cool, like, it's neat.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a little wink and a nod to that. One more, you know, another similarity. Both Galadriel and Morgan are wearing these white outfits, but they wear them in very different ways. They make us feel very differently. Morgan wears a chalk white outfit that sort of indicates some grayness, some ambiguity around her character. Galadriel's robes, on the other hand, are like pure white. Tolkien describes them as like wholly white, meaning in total they were white. But Carter points out that if you were just listening to that passage, it could have been mistaken for holy white, H-O-L-Y, white. So I thought that was kind of cool. Kind of neat.
Yeah.
So basically, in the end, Carter believes that Tolkien's writings of Morgan Le Fay had some influence over his character of Galadriel. Both significant characters with major roles in their respective stories, but both kind of work in the sidelines and off camera. And their role is sort of better understood at the end of their tales. But where Morgan is a very malicious character, Galadriel is the opposite. She's a beacon of hope. And her being that role really redeems this Lady of Lacuna character type. And I just, so when I read this paper, I just loved it. Like, I just got goosebumps thinking about it. There's so few ladies in Tolkien's Legendarium that this celebration
For sure.
of Galadriel, like, and this possible roots in Morgan Le Fay, even if it's not true, who knows? It just really made me feel good, and it kind of spoke to me a little bit. So,
No, I like it.
Yeah.
I've always found Galadriel a really interesting character. So I think I always appreciate seeing exegesis on some of these lesser known pieces that inform our understanding of her.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot more to talk about. And I think you could probably argue the other side, too, if you don't agree with Carter. Let us know. Right. I mean, I'm kind of sold
on
it. But like, hey, man, who knows? Right. Who knows? Just a couple, I know this is so long, but like a couple last things that I wanted to mention really quick. If you want, now this manuscript of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, the original one, has great illustrations. They're awesome. If you go to the British Library website, you can check them out. We will link to it in the show notes. Go look at the pictures. It's great. There's like a green guy without a head. It's rad. There is, if you're interested in learning a little bit more, there's a really nifty documentary that was made by BBC4. Hosted by Simon Armitage, that guy who I keep talking about. He visits all these landscapes of these Arthurian tales. Like, he goes to Tintagel, right, which is like where Arthur was maybe born, if he was a real guy. They go to Ludd's Church in the Peak District, sorry. And Ludd's Church is like where some people think maybe the Green Chapel is. It's really beautiful. You should look it up. L-U-D, Ludd's Church. Google it. It's cool. It's such a great documentary. It gets a little silly at times. He tries on armor and he gets punched in the stomach by a reenactor, which I like. And then there's like a very long scene of deer skinning and disemboweling, which I definitely could have lived without. But it's great. There's some weird music choices. It's a hoot. You can find it on YouTube. We will link to it in the show notes.
I definitely want to watch that now.
Yeah, it's rad. And then just the last thing I want to call out is this this illustrator, this artist who I really love. Her name is Emily Cheeseman. She does a lot of web comics. She's amazing. She did a web comic for Gawain and the Green Knight that tells the story. The piece started, as I said, a web comic back in 2016, and then it became a Kickstarter, and it was super successful. You can look at it online if you want to. It's great. She's a D&D nerd. She's a great illustrator. Check her out. Her website will be linked below. It's emilycheeseman.com. And you can find her on Twitter at emcheeseman and on Instagram at escheeseman. So check it out and let me know. And I guess that's kind of it. This was long, but thanks for sticking with me. Do you have any final impressions on Sir Gawain?
Well, I first want to say that this was a really impressive outline. I really, really enjoyed taking the more passive role on this one and just sort of soaking in the research that you did. I always get a real kick out of not being the research monkey on these episodes. And because I do love, one of the things I really love about Tolkien Academia is seeing how other people have interpreted Tolkien. Seeing how other people look at these stories that I'm so familiar with and reinterpret those stories and what connections they make. So I think it's really interesting in these cases to see a piece, whether I know the piece super well or not, to see what you think is interesting about it and to see what the research you found and see what those people, what connections those people drew. So it's really exciting and interesting for me. As far as this piece in specific goes, I really like the Morgan Le Fay Galadriel stuff. I think that's super interesting. And I really love the Fae connections stuff in this poem. I've always found that was really interesting. So I think that's very cool.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for sticking with it. And I know, again, it goes a little bit beyond what we normally talk about. It's not really part of the Legendarium, but I think it was definitely important to Tolkien. And so
I think it definitely has connections.
Yeah, I think so too. Cool. Well, thanks. This was great.
Yeah, I had a great time.
Thank you. Me too.
On and on, but this episode is over.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. It helps increase our visibility. You can find us on the web at www.podcast.athrobeth.com. You can find the show on Twitter at @athrobeth_cast. Jude can be found at @AremiticJude, and I can be found at @TheNorthFour. Title music is Lord of the Devil Rings by Pony Music, courtesy of Pond5. Thanks for listening.